The idea is that you inflict so much pain on Hezbollah's support base, on what is known here as the resistance community, that it turns against the group. And this is why we're seeing, you know, the scope of the targets is so wide. It is not just, you know, Israelis are not just targeting Hezbollah infrastructure, military targets. They're also targeting, as I said, people, displaced people who have escaped to parts of the country that are very far away from the border. They're targeting, the Lebanon's public health minister has said that he, you know, there are hospitals that have been bombed and closed their doors because of the threat of Israeli strikes. More than 100 paramedics have been killed. Medical centers have been targeted. So the targeting is very broad, and the idea is to try and, as I said, pry that support to say, actually, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem said this, not in his last speech, which was a few days ago, but in the one before that. He said, this is a war about who screams first. So it's about inflicting pain on the other side and who is going to say enough first. And the Dahi Doctrine thinks that if you inflict enough pain on Hezbollah's supporters, you will pry them away from the party.
Rania Abu Zeid is a Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll link to your piece for The New Yorker, War Comes to Beirut. Coming up, as aid groups warn Israel is wiping northern Gaza off the map, the Biden administration is threatening to cut military assistance to Israel in 30 days if more aid is not allowed into the area. We'll speak to former State Department official Josh Paul, who resigned in protest last year. Back in a minute.
Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg. All on board. Last train to Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Who held the rifle? Who gave the order? Who planned the campaign to lay waste the land? Who manufactured the bullet? Who paid the taxes? Tell me, is this blood upon my hand? Last train to Nuremberg. Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board.
Last train to Nuremberg by Pete Seeger. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Northern Gaza is being wiped off the map. That's the warning from Oxfam and 35 other humanitarian groups who say Israel's siege on northern Gaza has reached a, quote, horrifying level of atrocity. Earlier today, Israel's military bombed an UNRWA school in Jabalia, housing hundreds of displaced Palestinian families. Al Jazeera reports the death toll from the attack has climbed to 25, with many children among the dead. As Israel continues its siege on northern Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sent Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a letter Sunday threatening to cut off U.S. military assistance if Israel does not boost humanitarian aid access to Gaza within the next 30 days. The Biden administration has continued to arm Israel despite findings by its own experts at USAID and the State Department that Israel has routinely impeded delivery of food and medicine to Gaza in violation of U.S. law. Politico has revealed that in August, Biden's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues, Lise Grand, met with leaders of more than a dozen aid organizations and directly said the U.S. would not suspend arms to Israel. One person who attended the meeting told Politico, quote, she was saying that the rules don't apply to Israel. Grant also reportedly said the United States will not, quote, hold anything back that they want. We're joined now by Josh Paul. He's a former veteran State Department official who resigned in protest of the push to increase arms sales to Israel amid its assault on Gaza. He's a former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department. On Wednesday, he and Tariq Habash, who resigned in protest from the Education Department, announced the formation of a new lobbying organization and a political action committee called A New Policy to push for Washington to take a new approach on Israel-Palestine. Josh Paul, welcome back to Democracy Now! We'll talk about this new organization and the PAC that you've formed. But first, if you could respond to the letter that Austin and Blinken sent to Netanyahu, what it said and what it means that they gave Israel 30 days. Of course, in 30 days, that's after the U.S. elections will take place and a new administration will be in power.
Yes, thank you, Amy, and good to join you this morning. So I want to clarify to begin with that the letter that that Blinken and Austin sent to their counterparts in the Israeli government didn't actually threaten to cut off arms or to suspend security assistance. It simply said that there could be consequences under National Security Memorandum 20 and under U.S. law. What those consequences are, I think, remains to be seen, if at all. We have seen repeated expressions of concern from the United States government over the course of the last year. And yet what this letter makes clear in its detail, and it is a detailed letter, it lists, I believe, 15 steps the United States would like to see Israel take to facilitate the entry of humanitarian assistance into Gaza. What it does by doing so is demonstrate that the U.S. is currently in breach of its own laws. U.S. law says the U.S. cannot provide security or any form of assistance to a country that is restricting the delivery of U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. Here we have, in writing from this administration, a list of the ways in which Israel is doing so. And yet, U.S. military assistance continues to flow. And, of course, nowhere in the law does it say, you know, give them 30 days to see if they can fix it. The law is very clear that when it is made known to the president that assistance is being restricted, U.S. assistance cannot be provided. So I think that there is, you know, plenty of reasons for skepticism here. And, of course, while people are starving on a daily basis in Gaza, dying of malnutrition, the time for this to be fixed is now. The time for it to be fixed was actually almost a year ago, but it is certainly now, not in 30 days.
So, Josh Paul, if you can talk, although you left the State Department protesting U.S. policy on Israel, and you were the person who approved weapon sales within the State Department, you clearly still have contacts within the State Department. Can you talk about what people are saying? I mean, everything from the revelations of ProPublica, also us speaking to other people who quit over reports coming out of the State Department saying clearly Israel is cutting off, preventing humanitarian aid from coming in, and yet Blinken turns these reports around. What people are saying, are there more resignations within the State Department? And what the U.S. accomplishes, since Netanyahu is such a clear ally of Trump and wants him to win, yet Biden still embraces him, supports him. And even with this warning letter, as you said, you know, the election will happen by the time they were to cut off aid if Israel doesn't comply with what U.S. is demanding.
Yes, that last part in particular has been a bit of a mystery to me and I think lots of other people, because it has been very clear that Prime Minister Netanyahu has long had a preference for the Republican Party and for President Trump. He made that clear again when he came to Washington. He has made that clear in running rings around President Biden repeatedly over the course of the last year. So what the thinking there is on the part of Democratic strategists, I just can't fathom. You know, with regard to how things are playing out within the State Department, it's actually been a year to the day since I handed in my resignation at the State Department. And, you know, there was a significant increase in dissent in protest within the department in the initial months of this conflict. I think the challenge is that none of that really led to any policy because because what we have is a very tightly controlled set of decisions that are being made on a very political and politicized basis from the very top levels of the U.S. government. You noted that, you know, within the State Department, there has been increasing transparency and pushes from USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and from, for example, the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, to submit to Secretary Blinken evidence that Israel is restricting U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. I think it is worth noting that when ProPublica's piece came out 2 weeks ago, reporting that these reports had gone to Secretary Blinken and he had cast them aside, that report also noted that one of those officials, Julieta Valletta Noyes, Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees and Migration, had been asked if she felt that Section 620I of the law that says we cannot provide assistance in these circumstances had been triggered. Her initial response was yes. When she was pressed, she backed down. I think it's worth noting that she quietly resigned a week ago, shortly after the ProPublica story came out. So I think there is a degree still of concern and certainly of shame amongst higher-level officials. I know that amongst lower-level officials, there is immense pain. I've heard from people in the last week saying they don't know if they can do this any longer. At the same time, I think there's also a feeling of desperation and that there's really nothing under President Biden that can be done or can be changed from the inside on this issue. So people are waiting to see what happens next and what happens after the election.
And do you see, from your vantage point as an insider, any space between Biden and Harris?
I think that's very hard to say. Certainly, Vice President Harris, as a candidate, has not given us much evidence that there is any space. On the contrary, she has said repeatedly that she will continue the policies set by President Biden, including of unconditional support for Israel. There are people around Vice President Harris. Her policy team are, I think, different than those around Biden. And I think as well that Harris is not the ideologue on this issue that President Biden is. But I do think that what we face here is a deep-rooted and very entrenched set of political economic incentives that will make it very hard for anyone to change U.S. policy in this regard, regardless of the outcome of the election or of this election. This is something that is going to take a long time to resolve and a lot of effort. And to get to the point that you opened our session with, that's why Tariq Habash and I and a group of extraordinary, remarkable leaders, including former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford, have created a new policy. This is a lobbying organization and a political action committee founded on the idea that what we face here is actually not a policy problem. We know what the policy problems are. The people in government know what the policy problems are. What we face here is a political problem. And until we fix the politics, until we play within this ugly system that we have to make it work in the interests of the American voters, the American people, American values, and the interests of all of the people in the region, we are not going to make headway. So that is what we are out to do.
And Josh Paul, if you could also respond to recent reports that suggest that Israel will launch retaliatory strikes against Iran within the next 3 weeks, that is to say before the U.S. election. And although the Biden administration has reportedly won assurances from Israel that they will not attack Iranian nuclear or oil sites, of course, the implications of this would be enormous. If you could respond to that and how you think the Biden administration would respond in the event that Israel does attack Iran.
Well, so let's first of all remember that the Biden administration also won assurances from Israel back in April that it would conduct itself in accordance with international humanitarian law and not restrict the flow of humanitarian assistance in Gaza. So I'm not sure how much assurances from Israel at this point are worth or how credibly they can be taken. That said, I think that one of the things that is empowering Prime Minister Netanyahu in this situation is his knowledge that America has Israel's back, that no matter what Israel does, you know, we have deployed now a terminal high altitude air defense system, a THAAD system, which is our most capable and most expensive air defense system to Israel. We have deployed several squadrons of U.S. fighter jets. We have deployed U.S. Navy ships. And I think that the problem there is that we create for Prime Minister Netanyahu this ability to escalate without concern of the repercussions and indeed, if anything, a certain attraction one can imagine to him of getting America involved in a conflict with Iran that he has long craved. So I think these are indeed very dangerous times, particularly as we lead into a U.S. election here.
Finally, Josh, a new policy, the name of your new organization, a new policy's website says the United States policy in the Middle East should comply with American laws, reflect American values, advance peace, and peace and prosperity for all Americans. Are you saying now that the U.S. is breaking U.S. law?
So not only am I saying that the U.S. is breaking U.S. law, but I've actually heard, as have others who I'm working with from members of Congress behind closed doors, who will say, we believe that what Israel is doing with our weapons amounts to war crimes, but we won't say that publicly. What a new policy's mission ultimately is, as Tariq Abbas said today in the magazine Semaphore, is to change that, is to fix that, is to make it so that U.S. elected officials can vote in accordance with their voters' preferences, with their constituents' interests, with American interests, with American values, and with American law. We need to remove these structural roadblocks and these financial, frankly, roadblocks to our democracy and to the enforcement of our law. So if all of your listeners or viewers would like to visit, we're at www.anewpolicy.org and happy to continue the conversation there as well.
Thanks so much, Josh Paul, former director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department. He resigned in protest last year. He's just launched a lobbying group called A New Policy. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, we'll look at Israel's threats to launch retaliatory strikes against Iran as fears grow of a broader regional war. Over and Over Again by John Coltrane Quartet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. We end today's show looking at the rising risk of a broader regional war in the Middle East. The Pentagon has announced U.S. B-2 bombers attacked five Houthi targets in Yemen earlier today. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the attacks came in response to Houthis' quote, destabilizing behavior. Houthi fighters have attacked vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden since November and vowed to continue until Israel ends its assault on Gaza and Lebanon. This comes as the Biden administration is deploying an advanced anti-missile defense system and 100 U.S. troops to Israel as Israel threatens to carry out retaliatory strikes against Iran in response to Iran's recent ballistic missile attack on Israeli military and security sites. Earlier today, the commander of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards issued a new warning to Israel. The commander, Hossein Salami, was speaking at the funeral of Brigadier General Abbas Nilforoshan, who was killed in the Israeli attack that killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah.
You, Israel, may imagine that Thads can compensate for your shortcomings in defending you. This is a mistake. Do not trust the tubes of these launchers. You cannot massacre Muslim nations but remain safe, secure, and live in peace. No, that cannot happen.
We're joined now by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's the author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Trita. If you could just begin by responding to this latest news.
So I think it's extremely important for the American public to understand that what Biden has done here is that he has deployed U.S. troops into an active war zone in another country's war. There are no direct and clear U.S. interests at stake here. And the Biden administration is essentially presenting this as if it is defending Israel or helping Israel defend itself. Whereas in reality, these are the distinction between defensive and offensive weapons here is rather irrelevant, because what the Biden administration is doing is reducing the cost for Israel to escalate tensions in the region. Every time Biden does this, it makes it easier for Israel to escalate. And as a result, it has continues to do exactly that. If Biden was not reducing the cost of escalation, it would have been costlier for Israel to do the steady escalation as we've seen in the last year, widening of the war. And it would have thought twice. Perhaps the cost would even have been prohibitive. So if the Biden administration's actual goal is to prevent the widening of the war, prevent escalation in the region, adding defensive or any type of military capabilities to the side that actually is leading the escalation is not something that in any way, shape, or form actually can help calm the situation down. Instead, it actually helps fuel tensions in the region and increases the likelihood of the very same widening of the war that Biden claims that he is against.
Can you give us, Trita, a chronology of what happened, the bombing on the inauguration of the new president by Israel of Tehran? Not clear if it was an airstrike, if it was a bomb that was planted that killed the Hamas negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh. Then that was Israel. Iran waits weeks and then attacks with 180 anti-ballistic missiles that kill no one but a Palestinian who died from, not clear, the shrapnel that came down from the sky in Jericho. They said they were just targeting military sites in Israel. Is Iran coordinating, by the way, with the United States, actually, in all of this? Is there more behind-the-scenes communication than we understand?
There is behind-the-scenes communication, undoubtedly. And there is, perhaps at a surface level, a degree of coordination. I think the Iranians do not want to see escalation, knowing very well that they are in a weaker military position. And they know quite well that Netanyahu has been looking, itching for a war for quite some time, a war that he designs to drag the U.S. into it. And his best opportunity to drag the U.S. into this unnecessary war is in the next 3 weeks. So the Iranians have been rather restrained, hoping that they would avoid walking into Israel's trap. This is part of the reason why, after the assassination of Haniyeh, despite the fact that they promised a response, they didn't respond. They claimed that there were promises from the U.S. and Europe that there would be a ceasefire and that they waited to give that a chance. No ceasefire came. But on top of that, instead, Israel attacks Lebanon, kills Nasrallah, as well as the senior IRGC official. And after that, the Iranians decide to respond, and they do so by striking military targets. And in that strike, they also demonstrate their capacity to penetrate Israel's air defenses, which is precisely why when the THAAD is now being deployed over there in Israel, is an admission that the Israeli air defenses are insufficient. This, again, goes back to what I said earlier on. Every time Israel escalates the war, Biden rushes in to protect Israel from the consequences of its own escalation. That is not a strategy to prevent escalation. That is a strategy that fuels escalation.
So, Trita, could we also talk about what role countries in the region could potentially play in any possible retaliation against Iran? The Iranian foreign minister was recently in Riyadh. He's now in Egypt. But people have spoken specifically about Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Israel has been trying to persuade them to, quote, not facilitate any possible Israeli retaliation. If you could talk about the relationship between the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, the various sites at which they've been at odds, and where they stand at the moment vis-a-vis Iran.
There's been an interesting evolution of the position of the Saudis and the Emiratis. 15 years ago, they were not publicly, but privately, they were lobbying the U.S. quite aggressively to go to war with Iran. This was revealed by the WikiLeaks, in which the cables showed how much very senior officials, including the king of Saudi Arabia at the time, was pushing for the U.S. to go to war. This has now changed in the last couple of years. There's both been a bit of a rapprochement between these countries, but also a clear realization on the Saudi and the Emirati side that the Iranians actually have capabilities that go far beyond what they had expected, which means that in case of a war, the Iranians would have the capacity of destroying a tremendous amount of facilities in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And as a result, those two countries would suffer tremendously in the case of a war, which is something that they previously did not think was the case. Today, I don't think they are in any way, shape, or form eager for this type of a confrontation. And I think the message from the Iranian side to them has been that if they facilitate, if they allow their airspace to be used or their bases to be used for an attack against Iran, the Iranians will also retaliate against them directly. I think that message from the Iranians is sent to them in order for them to put pressure on the Biden administration to actually restrain Israel, something that the Biden administration has been unwilling to do. The Iranians don't have a direct way of pressuring the Biden administration, but they appear to be calculating that through Saudi Arabia and the UAE, there may be a greater likelihood that the Biden administration finally will do something to prevent the Israelis from further escalation.
Trita Parsi, according to The Washington Post, Israel's now considering striking military sites in Iran, but not Iran's oil or nuclear facilities. However, many in the U.S. and Israel are saying, take this moment to strike, take out Iran's nuclear facilities. We know, of course, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal that Obama had negotiated. What exactly would this mean, what is about to take place, apparently?
Most military analysis point to the fact that the Israelis actually don't have the capacity of delivering a fatal blow to Iran's nuclear facilities. They have been pushing for a larger attack, including against oil installations and economic infrastructure. The Biden administration has pushed back and has essentially delivered a list of military targets that they believe would be adequate for Israel's response. The Israelis reportedly have agreed to this, but I think it's very important to understand that most of this is frankly meaningless. Because once the Israelis strike, particularly if they strike against military sites and try to target military officials, as they have done in Lebanon, there will be civilian casualties. There will be an escalation that will almost make it inevitable for the Iranians to then respond again, which then means that in the second iteration of this, the Israelis are very likely to go after economic infrastructure, oil installations, and potentially the nuclear program as well. As long as we are on an escalatory cycle, it does not matter what the first step is. What matters is what the last step is. And as long as we are on that cycle and Biden is not preventing it, it's frankly meaningless if the first step is to avoid targeting nuclear sites and economic infrastructure. This will escalate towards a war in which all of those different things will be targeted, both on the Iranian side as well as on the Israeli side.
And Trita, finally, if you could respond to the fact that Netanyahu, much like we spoke about this in our earlier segment on Lebanon, much like as he did with Lebanon, gave a direct address to the Lebanese people, he did the same with Iran last month, saying with every passing moment, the Iranian government is bringing the noble Persian people closer to the abyss. What is the significance of this and why is he doing that?
Well, he's done this on previous occasions as well, not only in the context of Gaza and Lebanon, but in the case of Iran as well. I think the primary target of this is actually not the Iranian public. The message was in English and the original video had English subtitles. This is a message to the Western audience in order to present Israel's war of aggression as a defensive war, as a war that will help get rid of a very unpopular regime in Iran. And as a result, just as with the Iraq war, this deserves the support of the Western publics because the government in Iran is so problematic, similar to the argument against Saddam Hussein. And remember, it was Netanyahu who testified in Congress back right before the Iraq war, promising that an attack on Iraq would have positive reverberations throughout the entire region.
Thank you, Trita Parsi. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and The Triumph of Diplomacy. And that does it for our show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
We're all aware of the challenges our online spaces present, like online hate and the spread of misinformation. But how can the average person make our online world more positive? Studies have shown it takes just 10% of the people in a community to set its values. We're all digital citizens, and we all have a role to play. Join Media Smarts, Canada's Center for Digital Media Literacy, on October 23rd for Digital Citizen Day to help make our online world a better place to be. Visit digitalcitizenday.ca to find out how you can make a difference.